And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is May the 12th, 32nd day of the year. 233 days remain till the year's over with. On this day in 254, Pope Stephen I succeeds Pope Lucius I, becoming the 23rd Pope of the Catholic Church, and immediately takes a stand against Novatianism. Now, for those who don't know what that is, it was an early Christian sect devoted to the theologian Novatian that held a strict view that refused readmission to communion of lapsed Christians who had denied their faith and performed for pressures of the persecution sanctioned by Emperor Decius in AD 250. Church of Rome declared Novatianist heretic following the letters of St. Cyprian of Carthage, and Ambrose wrote against him. Novatianism survived until the 8th century. There's always somebody pointing the finger. 907, Zhu Wen forces Emperor Ai into abdicating. Ends the Tang dynasty after nearly 300 years of rule. England marries Berengaria of Navarre in Cyprus. She's crowned Queen Consort of England the same day. 1328, Antipope Nicholas V, a claimant to the papacy, is consecrated in Rome by the Bishop of Venice. 1364, Jagiellonian University, the oldest university in Poland, is founded in Krakow. 1497, Pope Alexander VI excommunicates Girolamo Savonarola. Or Jerome Savonarola, an Italian Dominican friar from Ferrara and preacher active in Renaissance Florence. He was known for his prophecies of civic glory, the destruction of secular art and culture, and his calls for a Christian renewal. He denounced clerical corruption, despotic rule, and the exploitation of the poor. That didn't sit well with the powers that be, because when you get to that level, of course you're going to take advantage of the less powerful. 1510, the Prince of Anhui Rebellion begins when Zhu Zifan kills all the officials invited to a banquet and declares his intent on ousting the powerful Ming Dynasty eunuch Lu Xun during the reign of the Xingde Emperor. 1551, National University of San Marcos, the oldest university in the Americas, is founded in Lima, Peru. 1588, French Wars of Religion. Henry III of France flees Paris after Henry I, Duke of Guise, enters the city and a spontaneous uprising occurs. 1593, London playwright Thomas Kidd is arrested and tortured by the Privy Council. What was his crime? Libel. People being murdered, but we're going to get those folks that say things we don't like. 1743, Maria Theresa of Austria is crowned Queen of Bohemia after defeating her rival, Charles VII, the Holy Roman Emperor. 1778, Henry XI, Count of the Principality of Rousse-Grèze, elevated to Prince by Joseph II, Holy Roman Emperor. 1780, American Revolutionary War, in the largest defeat of the Continental Army, Charleston, South Carolina, is taken by British forces. 1797, War of the First Coalition, Napoleon Bonaparte conquers Venice. 1797, War of the First Coalition. I'm sorry, 1808, Finnish War. Swedish-Finnish troops, led by Captain Carl Wilhelm Malmy, conquers the city of Kuopio from the Russians after the Battle of Kuopio. 1821, the first major battle of the Greek War of Independence against the Turks is fought at Feltesi. 1846, the Donner Party of Pioneers departs Independence, Missouri for California on what will become a year-long journey of hardship and cannibalism. 1862, American Civil War. Union Army troops occupied Baton Rouge, Louisiana. 1863, American Civil War, Battle of Raymond. Two divisions of James McPherson's 12th Corps turned the left wing of the Confederate General John Pemberton's defensive line on 14 Mile Creek. That opens up the interior of Mississippi to the Union Army during the Vicksburg Campaign. 1864, American Civil War, Battle of Spotsylvania Courthouse. Union troops assault a Confederate salient known as the Mule Shoe, with the fiercest fighting of the war, much of it hand-to-hand, occurring at the Bloody Angle on the northwest side. 1865, American Civil War, Battle of Palmetto Beach, first day of the last major land action to take place during the Civil War. It was a Confederate victory, but didn't go far. 1870, Manitoba Act is given the royal assent, paving the way for Manitoba to become a province of Canada on July 15th. 1881, in North Africa, Tunisia becomes a French protectorate. 1885, Northwest Rebellion. 4-day Battle of Batoche, pitting rebel Matisse against the Canadian government, comes to an end with a decisive rebel defeat. 1888, in Southeast Asia, the North Borneo Chartered Company's territories become the British Protectorate of North Borneo. 1926, the Italian-built airship Norge becomes the first vessel to fly over the North Pole. 1926, the 1926 United Kingdom General Strike ends on this date. 1932, 10 weeks after his abduction, Charles Jr., the infant son of Charles Lindbergh, is found dead near Hopewell, New Jersey, just a few miles from Lindbergh's home. 1933, the Agricultural Adjustment Act, which restricts agricultural production through government purchase of livestock for slaughter and paying subsidies to farmers when they remove land from planting, is signed into law by President Roosevelt. I remember my grandmother talking about having land in the land bank. 1933, President Roosevelt signs legislation creating the Federal Emergency Relief Administration. That's the predecessor to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or as we know it, those clowns at FEMA. 1937, the Duke and Duchess of York are crowned as King George VI and Queen Elizabeth of the UK of Great Britain and Northern Ireland in Westminster Abbey. They are the parents of the current queen. 1941, Conrad Zuse presents the Z3, the world's first working, programmable, fully automatic computer in Berlin. 1942, World War II, Second Battle of Kharkov. In eastern Ukraine, Red Army forces under Marshal Semyon Timoshenko launch a major offensive from the Azium bridgehead, only to be encircled and destroyed by the troops of Group Army South 2 weeks later. 1942, World War II. The U.S. tanker SS Virginia is torpedoed in the mouth of Mississippi by the German submarine U-507. 1948, Wilhelmina, Queen Regent of the Kingdom of Netherlands, cedes the throne to her daughter, Juliana. 1949, Cold War. Soviet Union lifts its blockade of Berlin. 1965, the Soviet spacecraft Luna 5 crashes on the moon. 1968, Vietnam War. North Vietnamese and Viet Cong forces attack Australian troops defending the fire support base Coral. 1975, Indochina Wars. Democratic Kampuchea naval forces captured the SS Mayaguez. 1978, in Zaire, rebels occupy the city of Kolwezi, the mining center for the province of Shaba, now known as Katanga. Local government asked the U.S., France, and Belgium to restore order. 1982, during a procession outside the shrine of the Virgin Mary in Fatima, Portugal, security guards overpower Juan Maria Fernandez y Cron before he can attack Pope John Paul II with a bayonet. 1989, a San Bernardino train disaster kills four. only to be followed a week later by an underground gasoline pipeline explosion that kills two more. 1998, four students were shot at Shirasaki University, leading to widespread riots in the fall of Suharto. 2002, former President Jimmy the Peanut Man Carter arrives in Cuba for a five-day visit with Fidel, becoming the first president of the U.S. in or out of office to visit the island since the Cuban Revolution. 2003, the Riyadh compound bombings in Saudi Arabia carried out by Al-Qaeda kills 39. 2006, mass unrest by the Primeiro Comando da Capital begins in Sao Paulo, Brazil, leaving at least 150 dead. 2006, Iranian Aziris interpreter cartoon published in an Iranian magazine is insulting, which results in massive riots throughout the country, which just goes to show some folks don't have a sense of humor. 2008, an earthquake measuring 8.0 occurs in Sichuan, China, kills over 69,000 people. 2008, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement conducts the largest ever raid of a workplace in Postville, Iowa, arresting nearly 400 immigrants for identity theft and document fraud. 2010, Africa Airways Flight 771 crashes on approach to Tripoli International Airport in Tripoli, Libya, kills 103 out of the 104 on board. 2015, train derailment in Philadelphia kills 8 and injures more than 200. Also in 2015, massive Nepal earthquake kills 218 and injures more than 3,500. 2017, the WannaCry ransomware attack impacts more than 400,000 computers worldwide, targeting computers of the United Kingdom's National Health Service and Telefonica computers. You know, the people that design these things are truly brilliant. I give them that. But they need to spend their time in something more constructive than disrupting the powers that be. 2018, Paris knife attack. Man is fatally shot by police officers in Paris after killing one and injuring several others with a knife. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays observances, Christian feast day, Blessed Imelda, Blessed Joan of Portugal, Crispoldus, Dominic de la Calzada, Epiphanius of Salamis, Gregory Dix in the Church of England, Moldoald, Nerus, Achilles, Domitia, and Pancras, Patriarch Germanus I of Constantinople in the Eastern Church, Philip of Agira, and his International ME, CFS, and Fibromyalgia Awareness Day. All right, let's see what else we got. In 1919, Duke Henry of Saxony becomes King Henry I of Ostfriesisch-Reich. 1057, the Ostromeyer Gospel, now the oldest surviving Russian manuscript, is recorded, completed by its scribe, Deacon Grigory. 1082, the Battle of Meilberg. Radoslav II of Bohemia beats Leopold II of Austria. 1215, on this date, English barons serve an ultimatum on King John that eventually leads to the creation and signing of the Magna Carta. 1216, was written in iron gall ink on parchment in medieval Latin. 1294, consecration of Santa Croce begins in Florence, the largest Franciscan church in the world. Consecrated in 1442. 1459, Jaipur, The Sun City is founded by Rao Jodhpur in India. 1534, German Duchy of Württemberg becomes Lutheran under Ulrich, Duke of Württemberg. In 1588, the Catholic League under Duke Henri de Guise occupies Paris. 1604, the Spanish Garrison of Ardenburg surrenders to Meridius. 1638, Emperor Shah Jahan commissions construction of the Red Fort at Shah Jahanabad in the Mughal Empire, which is now Delhi, India. 1640, there was an uprising against the Spanish King, Philip IV. 1695, English King William III departs to the Netherlands. 1776, French First Minister of State and Controller General of Finances, and Robert Jacques Turgot resigns after being ordered to do so. 1777 saw the first ice cream advertisement, Philip Lindsay, in the New York Gazette. 1780, American General Benjamin Lincoln surrenders Charleston to the British. 1784, saw ratified copies of the Treaty of Paris, ending the Revolutionary War exchange between the U.S. and Great Britain. 1789, the Society of St. Tammany is formed by Revolutionary War soldiers. It later becomes an infamous group of New York City political bosses, Tammany Hall. 1797, the Norrie Mutiny. British Royal Navy sailors mutiny on the Thames in England and blockade London. 1821 saw the first major battle of the Greek War of Independence against the Turks occur in Eltetsi. 1835, on this date, Charles Darwin visited the Panuncio copper mine in North Chile. 1864, the Battle of Drury's Bluff fought in Chesterfield County, Virginia. That was a Confederate victory. 1864 saw the Battle of Spotsylvania, also called Spotsylvania Courthouse, as it was fought near the courthouse as part of the Overland Campaign. The battle was inconclusive. 1864 saw U.S. Union Colonel Emory Upton, who was only 24 years old, promoted to Brigadier General. 1871, segregated streetcars are integrated in Louisville, Kentucky. 1873, Oscar II of Sweden and Norway is crowned King of Sweden. 1881, the Treaty of Bordeaux resulted in Tunisia becoming a French protectorate. 1885 saw the Battle of Batoche. Louis Riel and the Matisse are defeated by Frederick Middleton, leads to the collapse of the provincial government of Saskatchewan and the surrender of Riel. 1881, for those that are interested, crouching to start a race was first used in track and field by Charles Sorrell of Yale. 1890, on this date, Louisiana legalized prize fighting. 1891, there was a riot against the tax increase in Paramaribo, Suriname. 1897, Battle of Thessaly. The Turkish army beat the Greeks. In 1900, there was a Boer attack under Cyril Iloff. 70 are killed. 1900, Old Roberts' British forces occupy Crown City during the Boer War. 1908, wireless radio broadcasting is patented by Nathan Stubblefield. 1910, saw the second NAACP conference in New York City. 1915, the Croatians plunder Armenia. 250 people are killed in the process of doing that. 1921, National Hospital Days, first observed in the U.S. 1928, Benito Mussolini announced a move to end women's suffrage in a speech to the Senate in Italy. He firmly believed women's place was in the home. 1928, the second opium law was introduced. It was international law to control drugs. 1940, French Marines occupy St. Martin. 1940, German tanks conquer Moerdijk bridges in the Netherlands. Also on this date, Nazi Blitzkrieg and the conquest of France began with the crossing of the Meuse River. 1941, Martin Bormann succeeded Rudolf Hess as Adolf Hitler's deputy. And the reason for that was Hess decided to do a one-man peace attempt by parachuting into Scotland. 1943, the Axis forces in North Africa surrender. 1943, also saw German troops in Tunisia and North Africa surrender. 1944, 900 plus 8th Air Force bombers attack Zwickau, Bolin, and Brooks. 1944, the Crimea is purged of Nazi soldiers. 1949, saw the first foreign woman ambassador received in the U.S., Vijaya Lakshmi Pandit of India. 1970, when his state, Ernie Banks hit his 500th home run. We've been talking about a lot of little-known aspects of the Nazis' rise to power. You know, a lot of their activities was funded by American millionaires and corporations. And it was all done in order to oppose the rising menace, supposedly, of communism. Now, what's the most interesting part of it is the Bolsheviks rose to power on American dollars. So that does also raise numerous interesting questions. Now, we're going to turn our attention from the Nazis to Las Vegas. And I first went to Las Vegas when the mafia was running the place. And they couldn't do enough for the guest. Once corporations took over, guests were treated rather rudely. In fact, I had someone sit in my... I went there for a book signing. I had books in the car. And they sat in the car with my car with the lights on, ran the battery down, and stole a couple of books. And when the casino was notified, they didn't care. Well, Las Vegas was actually the American dream. A treasure trove, gangster style. During the heyday of Vegas, which was roughly 1950 to about 1980-81, the mob was skimming an estimated $1 million a day for casino account rooms. Every week, a courier with a suitcase full of skim cash traveled by train to fill the mob coffers back east in places like Kansas City, Chicago, Milwaukee, and Miami. Meanwhile, the multi-million dollar pension fund loans to finance mob-run casinos kept on coming, as were the loan kickbacks to people like Jimmy Hoffa, the Teamster General President and a big supporter of Vegas. And just as the mob controlled Hoffa, they controlled an endless stream of capital to build their temples of money. By the late 1950s, no mob in America could resist the lure of Las Vegas. And let's face it, they had it made. Skimming profits from a city, especially one with no law enforcement to get in the way. Whatever they could lift, they could have. Well, in 1957, at the pinnacle of the mob's heyday, the Tropicana opened and instantly became the most glamorous resort hotel in town. Modeled after the tropical mob-owned casinos in Havana, even had an 18-hole golf course. Shortly after the Tropicana opened up, the mob influence over Sin City's casino was inadvertently exposed when Frank Costello, one of America's most notorious gangsters, was shot by a rival gang member outside his New York apartment. Well, the injury was, frankly, very minor. But while Costello was recovering in the hospital, police discovered an interesting note in his pocket. And that note was a list detailing cash amounts from the Tropicana to be distributed to known organized crime figures. This was, for the very first time, proof the mob was skimming in Las Vegas. But, as you might guess, when that much money's involved, the government showed very little concern. It didn't interest New York police, didn't interest the FBI, whose official position was there was no mafia. They were busy fighting communism. Then in the mid-1960s, the mob sent Frank Rosenthal to Vegas to run their casinos and later sent his old friend Tony Spilotro as the overseer. Rosenthal had the smarts and he could provide the skim, and Spilotro made sure the mob got their weekly suitcases full of millions of dollars in skim cash. With Rosenthal's obsession for running the town and Spilotro's penchant for breaking the rules, as you might guess, eventually it all came down. Years before the syndicate bosses at Rule Sin City came to the conclusion doing business profitably in Las Vegas required there be certain rules. Businesses could not be conducted the old-fashioned way. During Prohibition, territories were divided up among gangs with the help of machine guns and dynamite. And violence wouldn't work in a city to become to thrive on gambling tourists. And if the mob was going to flourish, the gaming aficionados in their high desert refuge had to get along, maintain a low profile, and stay out of the spotlight. Gang war and bloodshed were taboo. That had to be the case to keep Las Vegas from being labeled as nothing more than a killing field and a city of nefarious gambling joints. To secure the city's image, the mob bosses mandated contract murders must be performed outside of Nevada. And this avoided any heat from law enforcement. So when the decision is made to eliminate the Flamingos, Ben Siegel in June of 1947 and Riviera's Gus Greenbaum in December 1958, the killings had to take place someplace else. Now, when Chicago outfit sent Tony Spilotro as the overseer to reassert its authoritarian rule over the street rackets, these syndicate rules became obsolete. Within weeks, the discovery of five dead bodies, all of whom were ex-loan sharks, beaten with their throats slashed. But these five dead bodies found in the desert outside Vegas instigated the bloody era in Sin City. And that kind of action was precisely what the city's founding fathers had feared would happen. High-profile violence inevitably led to exposure to the casino scam and the fall from grace of the traditional mob and casino front offices. Well, just prior to the beginnings of the mob's heyday in Vegas, an ex-Dallas mob boss named Benny Binion pulled up stakes in 1947, moved his family to Las Vegas. It was through his efforts that the style of gambling was changed forever in America. Now, the life and times of the Binion family and their move to Glitter Gulch and how they built the city's most profitable casino reads like a captivating crime saga that's hard to put down. Begins with the intriguing story of blood feud between Benny and his ex-business partner, Herbert Noble. This feud ended up with two dead bodies and a third person serving 5 years in prison. And also a number of stories of unrecovered buried treasure. Now, by the summer of 1949, the ongoing Noble-Binion blood feud had endured more than a year, with Herbert Noble surviving 9 attempts on his life. Till then, the failed assaults were orchestrated by gunmen and drive-by shootings. But that state of affairs changed considerably. The bounty that Binion put on Noble's head doubled from $25,000 to $50,000. And the size of that prize was rumored to lure a professional trio of killers to North Texas to finish the job. While Benny Binion was grappling with problems at his Horseshoe Club in Vegas, the 10th attempt on Herbert Noble's life came in the form of a car bomb. And this happened the morning of November 29, 1949. Instead of killing Noble, it actually killed his wife Mildred and instigated a vendetta that fester for 16 long months. Later, when detectives questioned Noble about possible suspects in the crime, he refused to mention any names. Nevertheless, with an evil glare in his eyes, Noble could only speak of an ex-Dallas gambling boss who now lived 1,500 miles away in Las Vegas. Well, there were certain preludes to this storybook feud. 1977, the feds figured they had Sheriff Ralph Lamb nailed to the wall. But U.S. District Judge Roger Foley acquitted Lamb of all charges. He said the IRS had failed to prove that anybody paid for the building materials, so They were probably gifts, not subject to taxation. Now, that acquittal came after Benny Binion, who owned the Horseshoe Casino, was the next Dallas mob boss, came forward and swore under oath that the $30,000 in question was not a gift, but an unsecured promissory note underwritten by the Binion family. Now, that story came out of the Las Vegas Review-Journal, written by A.D. Hopkins. Now, Benny Binion always knew how to take care of his friends, especially those in high places. Since 1936, when the local papers began to refer to Benny as the Dallas kingpin of underworld gambling, he had maintained connections with key Dallas politicians. That was also the year that Benny earned the title the Boss Gambler. Now, this was a nickname. The road gamblers, hustlers, and racketeers who continually drifted in and out of town knew him by. Benny started out in the 20s working as a street corner bootlegger under the guise of a newspaper boy until he had charmed and bribed and shot his way to the top of the Dallas underworld. One of the reasons for Binion's success was even in the Depression, Dallas was flush with oil money. And during World War II, entire divisions of GIs learned to shoot craps in barracks and motor pools and lot headed to Dallas to buck the bigger banks and honest dice Binion was known to provide. In the final years of his life, Benny maintained an office downstairs near the entrance to the Sombrero Room Cafe. And I've been to his casino, and I remember seeing it years ago. And he liked to pass the time with whoever might happen by. And when he wasn't in his office, he could usually be found in the Sombrero Room sitting in his big leather booth in the back corner drinking coffee. Technically speaking, only Benny or his invited guests sat at that particular leather booth because, well, frankly, he owned it. For that matter, he owned the whole place, the hotel, the casino, and the cafe. Sign out front on Fremont Street said Binion's Horseshoe Club. $100 chips in the casino had his picture on them. Even the specialty of the house in the Sombrero Room was named after him. It was called Benny Binion's Jailhouse Chili. Well, from 1947 to 1953, Benny owned and operated Binion's Horseshoe Club. Almost from the day it opened, it was the most profitable casino in Las Vegas. But after a 1953 felony conviction for income tax evasion, he was prohibited from holding a Nevada gambling license. From that point forward, his two sons ran the downtown Horseshoe. Jack Binion, the older, was president, and Ted Binion was casino manager. 1958, after completing a 5-year term of incarceration, Benny actually worked as the Horseshoe's consultant out of his downtown office. Well, even a stretch in Leavenworth couldn't stop Benny from coming down to the Horseshoe coffee shop dressed in his big Stetson, his cowboy shirt with the butts made from $3 gold pieces and ostrich boots. And it didn't keep him from talking about gambling, rodeos, his days in Dallas, and just about any other subject a person might want to talk about. One of his favorite stories had to do with the suitcase man, William Lee Bergstrom. Texas gambler who wanted to try his luck and risk it all on one throw of the dice. Well, in the early 80s, Bergstrom decided to test the claim that Binion's Horseshoe would book any bet, no matter how large, as long as it was the first wager a player made. Bergstrom arrived at the Horseshoe with a suitcase crammed full of money and said he wanted to bet the entire amount on the don't pass line at craps. Casino supervisor took the suitcase to the cashier's cage. The amount was verified at $777,000. Suitcase full of money was physically placed on the don't pass line. The shooter, a lady, came out with a roll of six, then sevened out two rolls later. Casino supervisor counted out $777,000 in casino checks. Bergstrom picked up the winning checks, the suitcase full of cash, cashed it all in at the casino cashier, and left. Or you might hear the story about a poker game took place in 1949 between Nick the Greek Dindelos and Johnny Moss. Spread the game for him right out there in front of the casino. Game went on for almost 4 months. Johnny won about $400,000. Interestingly, the 42-year-old Moss had to rest by taking naps on a regular basis. During the naps, Nick the Greek, who was 57, passed his time playing craps. After months of playing heads-up poker and seeing his opponent, Johnny Moss, win a small fortune, Dindelos uttered one of the most famous poker statements of all times. "Mr. Moss, I have to let you go." But most of all, Benny Binion left to talk about his days in Dallas. The high times of running wide open, no restrictions. He loved the stories of bootleggers, cowpunching, and gamblers, and when he fell up to it, he would tell stories about the Prohibition days in Dallas. All you had to do was ask, as did a reporter from the Houston Chronicle who once asked Benny in an interview about his early days in North Texas. He said, "Yes, sir, I can damn sure tell you about Dallas. I can tell you the truth, too." And then he smiled and he said, "I'll tell you the truth, but I ain't going to tell you everything." Well, it was Hopkins who said, in describing Benny Binion, he was a cowboy who pushed the limits. A Texan knew a thing or two about horse trading and gambling and laid his cream on Fremont Street and changed the face of Western hospitality. He was born the son of a North Texas horse trader, November 20th, 1904, near the tiny community of Pilot Grove in Grayson County, about 50 miles north of Dallas. And Benny spent a lot of his early years traveling with his father around the panhandle. Because of his poor health, by the age of 10, he was stricken with pneumonia on at least 4 occasions. His parents kept him out of school, thinking the boy would benefit from being in the open air. Well, he spent that time learning to gamble with traders who gathered with his father at the various campgrounds near Western rodeos and other popular events where horses were bought and sold, such as county fairs. Benny became fascinated with the gambling and the gamblers and took particular interest in the dice games, which he watched carefully and learned. During those days when he traveled with his father, the horse traders and road gamblers played money craps as opposed to bank craps. Bank craps is a casino game played today on complex layouts with 3 croupiers and a box man watching over the game, protecting the bank of $500,000 or more. In money craps, the shooter announces the amount of money he wants to wager. And other players in the game have the option to cover all or any portion of the wager. Should the other players not fade the entire wager, the shooter has the option of rolling the dice for the amount the faders have agreed to wager or pass the dice to the next shooter. And proposition bets between players are permitted, such as the shooter making his point of 10 the hard way, such as 5 and 5 versus rolling 6 and 4, which in casino parlance is called the easy way. Players in money craps are also permitted to wager each other for or against the shooter. Well, until the age of 16, Benny lived the life of a nomadic horse trader. But at 16, he decided to go out on his own. Benny actually wrote his biography called "I'll Do My Own Damn Killing." And he described Benny as, on his 16th birthday, a full-grown, robust young man, round face, smiling under his newsboy's cap, 6 feet tall, weighed about 190. For the next 6 years, Benny traveled across most of Texas, spent most of his life in El Paso, described as a wild and woolly frontier town. Prohibition became law of the land in 1919. A large-scale whiskey smuggling business develops along the Mexican border across the Rio Grande. And most likely, Benny earned a lot of his income transporting the illegal alcohol from Mexico into El Paso. And certainly, I can tell you what the tunnels are. Usually talkative Benny, who at a drop of a hat could overflow, jawing about his life in Texas, became unnaturally quiet when queries were made about his days in El Paso. In his waning days, a few months before he died, Benny was asked by a newspaper reporter about his days in El Paso. He said, "I got to be known pretty fast," he said. Reporter asked him how, and he said, "I don't want to tell it." Well, for whatever reason, by 1922, Benny had enough of El Paso and relocated to Dallas and took up bootlegging. Under the pretext of being a newspaper boy, he sold bootleg whiskey on downtown street corners with two young men who would evolve into his lifelong friends. Chill Wills, who went on to become a major Hollywood character actor, and Johnny Moss, one of the world's greatest tournament poker players. In 1989 interview with Stephen Reed of the Houston Chronicle, Benny said, "I bootlegged in and out of town. I'd leave and come back, in and out. I'd leave town, go out and punch cows, trade horses, do something like that, and come back. Never made no money in nothing. Started making money from about 26. By the 1930s, Dallas owed its fortune to the production of two commodities, cotton and crude oil. City located at the convergence of two railroads, which in the late 1800s made it a natural shipping center for the cotton produced throughout central northern Texas. By the turn of the century, Dallas had become the world's largest cotton market. 1930, Dallas also saw the beginnings of a sizable oil boom. As luck would have it, a 70-year-old wildcatter named Columbus Marion Dad Joyner, convinced he could locate oil in East Texas, began drilling in Rusk County, about 50 miles east of Dallas. After two dry holes, he drilled one last well on the spot where his truck broke down. This third well, the one he called the Daisy Bradford No. 3, became the largest find in that huge East Texas oil field. In fact, the largest in the world at that time. And soon a myriad of oil derricks spotted the East Texas plains. While Texas, along with the rest of America, suffered in the grips of the Great Depression during the 1930s, Dallas prospered. Oil fields brought jobs for roughnecks and pipe fitters and truck drivers and mechanics and tool pushers and all of whom spent their paychecks in Dallas. As the money flowed, oil-related businesses sprang up around the country around the city. Contractors, equipment suppliers, and speculators all came to Dallas, as well as the established oil fields in Beaumont and neighboring Louisiana, convenient locations for a base of operations. By 1933, the petroleum industry had supplanted the cotton market as the lifeblood of the Dallas economy, and the city's population swelled to more than 250,000, practically doubling in the previous 10 years. About this time, the city was also aided by the completion of a mammoth project redirecting the Trinity River Channel, which finally relieved the threat of constant flooding. Well, in his younger days as a bootlegger in North Texas, Benny carried three pistols, two .45 automatics holstered under each shoulder, and a small .38 revolver in his coat pocket. When he developed underworld gambling in Dallas, the ocean of money he made attracted ruthless pirates. There was a rumor that, for whatever reason, when Benny had to kill somebody, he'd shoot his victim with a .45 and use the .38 to shoot himself, inflicting a non-fatal wound, for instance, in the fleshy upper arm. Allegedly, at that point, he had put the .38 near the body of the man he had shot to make it appear the victim had shot at him. It's also rumored that later, when Benny surrendered to the police, he'd claim self-defense, claiming that the dead man shot first. 1931, Benny suspected fellow bootlegger Frank Balding of hijacking the truckload of his liquor. He confronted Balding, who, according to Ted Binion, was a real bad man and had a reputation for killing people by stabbing them. One confrontation, Balding stood up real quick, and Dad felt like he's going to stab him, so Binion rolled back, pulled his gun, and shot upward from the ground. Hit him through the neck and killed him. That incident earned Benny his nickname, the Cowboy. Also got him a murder conviction. During the investigation, authorities discovered Balding had a knife but hadn't pulled it. Nevertheless, Benny received only a 2-year suspended sentence because Bowling's reputation was, in fact, so bad as a killer. Well, by 1936, Benny became the reigning mob boss of Dallas. Soon after that, he tried to muscle in on the gambling rackets in nearby Fort Worth. Mob boss of that city, Lewis Tyndall, was found dead. Well, September 12, 1936, Benny Binion cruised through North Dallas in his Cadillac. Buddy Malone was the driver. Now, Malone's the chief lieutenant in Benny's lucrative policy business, a numbers racket that was the bread and butter of his underworld gambling empire. Earned him $1 million annually. That afternoon, Benny Malone drove toward the Pride of Dallas Cafe, a popular establishment in the predominantly African-American part of town. They were going to survey the action in their territory. When they turned north onto Allen Street, Benny spotted Ben Frieden sitting in the car parked at the curb in front of the cafe. Frieden was a 46-year-old bookmaker and gambler who'd come to Dallas from California at the onset of the oil boom. He operated a produce business in Dallas public market, but had recently started a small but expanding policy game in North Dallas. Now, of course, as you might guess, Benny didn't take kindly to interlopers moving in on his business. And Frieden's so-called top-notch policy wheel hadn't escaped the boss gambler's attention, so Benny had warned the intruders to find another city for his policy racket, preferably in another state. When Benny spotted his competition conducting business out in the open, he became furious. And Benny, whose tough reputation was already legendary in Dallas, especially after killing Frank Boulding 5 years before, yelled at Malone to stop the car. Cowboy threw the Cadillac's door open, ran to the passenger side of Frieden's automobile, reached through the open window, and slapped him across the face. Benny then screamed, USOB, you're a sucker in the business. You don't know no better, and I'm going to forgive you this time, but don't come around here again, or I'll whip you. Frieden said, you might do it, but you won't do it today. Now, what happened next is not really totally clear. The version told by Binion and Malone was that Frieden pulled a pistol and shot at Binion. Bullet hit him in the right arm. Binion went for his shoulder holster, grabbed a .45 and shot Frieden in the heart. Sound of the gunfire, Malone leapt from his boss's car and simultaneously pulled out his own .45 and began shooting through the driver's side window. According to what Binion later said, old buddy just shot the heck out of him. Well, during the gunfight, Frieden's chauffeur, George Parker, somehow eluded the bullets aimed at Frieden. He escaped from the melee relatively unharmed, but nearly deafened. So traumatized, he was incapable of making a statement to detectives. When Benny Malone got back into their car and drove away, there was not a policeman to be seen. Minutes later, when the police arrived on the scene, they found Parker clutching the wheel so severely shaken he was incoherent. Frieden was dead, 6 wounds in his chest and back. And lying on the seat next to his body was a .38 revolver containing one spent cartridge. Well, 3 hours later, Benny surrendered to authorities for the killing of Frieden. 2 days passed before Malone turned himself in and confirmed Benny's version of the story. Frieden shot first and Benny fired in self-defense. Well, nevertheless, investigators found witnesses who claimed they saw Benny toss an object into Frieden's car after the gunfight, which, of course, conjured up worries that the .38 found next to Frieden's body had been Binion's. Binion and Malone were indicted, but 3 months later, the judge dismissed the indictments based on lack of evidence. Well, by 1936, with protection from the police and local politicians, Benny gained control of gambling operations in Dallas. At that time, the local FBI office already had an extensive open file on Benny Binion. It included mentions of contacts with wise guys in the Eastern mob, including Meyer Lansky, and connections to the Chicago mob. But into World War II, more than 24 casinos operated illegally in downtown Dallas hotels, and Benny Binion owned at least half of them. But it was Benny's numbers racket that gave him most of his wealth, $1 million annually, and in 1936, that was an unbelievable sum of money. And Benny, of course, did not like competition, moving in on his bread and butter. But an ambitious ex-partner of Benny's named Herbert Noble had dreams of being a gambling boss, and when Sam Murray was killed, Noble quickly became the Cowboys' only true rival for gambling supremacy in Dallas. Well, Herbert Noble was born in April 1909, 80 miles west of Fort Worth. And by his 9th birthday, his family settled in North Dallas. The impoverished creation is now technically West Dallas,
didn't exist. The impoverished creation was described by author Gary Sleepers, the bastard stepchild of the city of Dallas. It's on the west bank of the Trinity, almost in the shadows of the downtown skyscrapers. And most of the residents live in shacks they built from material scavenged from the dump nearby. Upscale poor West Dallas owned the rented dilapidated shacks that had been wheeled over the river from Dallas and put down wherever a flat and hopefully elevated parcel of land could be found. Essentially, there was an unincorporated slum with no zoning, hardly any running water, and one paved street called Eagle Ford Road. When it rained, the Trinity River offered overflowed its banks and swamped the area, leaving the ramshackle housing in ruin and the dirt roads a muddy mess. Well, on that note, we've come to the end of today's show. We're going to talk more about some of the wild and wild stories of Las Vegas tomorrow. And once again, you'll hear Ken Hudnall and the Ken Hudnall Show. Until then, have a truly great evening.